Gorvy Dahl is the author of something like 25 novels, 200 essays, numerous plays, and even he doesn't remember how many movie and television scripts he's written. His latest project is a photo book with lots of text called Snapshots in History's Glare. It's published by Abrams, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Vidal back to our program today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Well, particularly now that everything has been changed here, it's full of light.
Our new studios are quite wonderful. This collection has been called a visual memoir. So much has happened in your life. Were there things that you might have forgotten if you hadn't had all of this memorabilia to jog your memory?
Well, I forgot being born, and I was trying to check to figure out when it was. The other day I had a birthday, everybody reminded me, and I didn't remember when I was born. So I didn't know how old I was. So
you mean you really forgot your birthday?
Yeah, that's why I'm always 18.
Well, how much material did you have to sift through to create this collection? Because I was wondering, have you thrown anything away over the years?
I tend not to. On the other hand, I never look at it again, so it just piles up. But I made a deal with the Knowlton Library at Harvard. They get all of my papers and manuscripts and so forth, and they have a nice collection. They keep it beautifully up in Cambridge. And but mostly the pictures in this were kept by my friend Howard Auster, who wanted to make a book out of just the pictures, knowing that I would never look at them or do anything with them. So he was all set to go, and then he crossed the Shining River.
So you really completed this project for him in a way?
Well, more Abrams did, you know. Other hands have been in the mix.
But you did write the text to go along with these things, so you have really participated in this project.
Pages and pages and pages of new text, yes, and some new jokes. I've got a new Kennedy story which has never been printed. I'll practice my Kennedy accent. After Jack became president in 1960, Joe became concerned that all the Kennedy children, Jack's brothers and sisters, were all spending so much money, and they didn't have it. And he called everybody, all the family, down to Palm Beach for a lecture from the old man himself. And he said, you know, this fabulous Kennedy fortune, he said, doesn't exist. It's just what I have and what I have had. And the election has taken care of most of that. And indeed, the only pair of you that are living on their income are Teddy and his wife then. And the rest of you are spending and spending and spending. And I'm here to tell you that the famous Kennedy fortune is about to vanish. So needless to say, all the siblings sat there looking rather grim. And Joe was breathing fire. And he said, do I hear any suggestions about what we might do? And a silence from all of them. And he said, very respectfully, Joe Kennedy, he was very impressed by his son, the president. Does the president have nothing to say about this family crisis? The fact that the money is just about finished for the next generation. And Jack, I got this from him, by the way.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, it came from him. And he said, well, he said, this is sad news. And I think we're all disturbed at the wild spending that is going on, not mentioning that Jackie was responsible for a great deal of it. And moving into the White House was even being suddenly more expensive for the whole family, because they ended up paying much more than the government did. And finally, Joe was getting rather angry, and nobody had come up with any solution like, you know, we'll all cut back 20%. There was none of that. And finally, Joe was getting irritable, and he said, Mr. President, you have no ideas. This is an important thing in your administration. And Jack said, well, it seems to me that you've got to start working a lot harder than you've been used to.
Now, he told you that story.
Yes, he did.
You have pictures here with him and with President Carter and with Tennessee Williams, with Truman Capote, with William Burroughs, Mick Jagger, Andy Warhol, Johnny Carson, Lauren Bacall, Joan Didion, just to name a few. You always seem to have been in the right place at the right time. I would say this is a kind of a Zelig thing, except that Zelig was a kind of chameleon and you are anything but. But was it just luck that put you into...
No, it was relationship. I am a cousin of Jimmy Carter. Blood cousin from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Due to a series of divorces, Jackie and I shared the same stepfather for a number of years. I have nothing to do with all that trafficking, but that went on around me.
And then, of course, Gore reflects a relationship with the former vice president, Al Gore. Your baptismal name was Eugene Luther Vidal.
No, Eugene Luther Gore Vidal.
Oh, the Gore was still in there.
Yeah, and then I got rid of Eugene Luther, who wants to be called that.
Well, that was your father's name, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's okay for him, but I'm not he. He was an All-American football player, and I barely touch football.
But he also was very much into aviation, and there is a photograph in this book of you at the controls of a plane.
Yeah, that was...
Did you fly?
Yes, I took it off, landed it in 1936 for Pathé News, and anybody who wants a copy of the great event of me, age 10, flying this plane, Pathé News has it, and they sell it in England. Because they sell year by year, 1935, 1936. Well, I'm 1936. And if you really want to see me take it off and make one of the worst landings on Earth, there it is.
But that's the reason you flew is because your father had developed a plane that he said even a child could fly.
Well, he was promoting it. He was director of Air Commerce. It wasn't his plane.
He was in the FDR's administration?
It was the cabinet, basically. Mm-hmm. Congress wouldn't put up any money for a Secretariat of Aviation, which they should have done, because it was quite clear and made clear by Lindbergh and my father, his friend, that Lindbergh was not a Nazi, may I quickly say, and he was dedicated to American air power.
But he sure admired Hitler.
He did not.
Even his own family says that.
No, they don't say it. Well, I've talked to them, too. He did not admire Hitler. He was not political, and he wasn't interested. Roosevelt was deeply jealous of Lindbergh. Roosevelt felt there could only be one great man per country at a given time, and that was he. And I'm quite willing, in a way, to agree with Roosevelt. I think he was one of our great presidents. And it took a great president to get through what he did, not only a depression, but real world wars instead of these invented wars by crazy young people from Texas. No, he was sent by the president, Roosevelt. Lindbergh was sent to Germany to find out the strength of the Luftwaffe. And Goering, who was in charge of the Air Force over there, had wanted Lindbergh to come over to give him an Iron Cross. Well, that's Goering's business, not Lindbergh's. Lindbergh does as requested and comes back and terrifies my father, first of all. He reported to him, the director of Air Commerce, and then he reported to the president. And he said, if you have a war in mind, Mr. President, you must know that they are more powerful than we are in air power. And Gene Vidal, my friend here, because me and my father worked together on five airlines, he said, we have, I think, a means of drawing parity from our air forces to the German ones, if there's to be such a war. And he said, he presented Roosevelt with a B-17. The Flying Fortress, and that is how that started. And that is how our absolute lead in air power came about. It was Lindbergh to Jean Vidal to President Roosevelt.
But wasn't Lindbergh also opposed to World War II?
Well, so was I, and so was the Socialist Party of the United States.
And your grandfather was opposed to World War I as well, the grandfather
exactly,
named Gore.
Exactly. And so was General Washington, opposed to foreign wars. We were obedient to the original Constitution that only the president can declare a war.
So would it have been okay for us to not have engaged in those wars, considering what was going on, the threat of the Kaiser in Europe and then Hitler in Europe later?
Tell us about the threat of the Kaiser. I'd like to know.
Well,
Woodrow Wilson couldn't tell us, but maybe you can.
Well, that was the war to end all wars and to defend democracy, wasn't it?
What a success it was, yes.
You say that your grandfather, you really took the name Gore as a way of honoring your grandfather.
No.
No?
I was Eugene Luther Gore Vidal. Well, that's a little too much to put on the spine of a book.
Mm. And at 14, you decided that you were going to be writing books and you needed to have a shorter name to put on the spine?
I was already printing stuff, and so I cut the name down to Gore Vidal.
But you do seem to have had real affection for your grandfather.
Of course I did.
You tell the story about your grandfather's library. Is that where you forged your love of books?
Well, it forged me, I can say that. No, he said something like 14,000 books, and then he rented the house. He had to take retirement from the Senate briefly. But he came back in 1936, he came back. But meanwhile, the lady to whom he had rented his house and his library, she decided to reorder the books, not according to topic, which he had, but according to the color of the binding. So he had red books, and he had blue books, and he had yellow books, and black books, and brown books, and he had all kinds of books. And she wrecked his life. He never could get his library in shape again.
My guest is Gore Vidal. His latest book from an unlikely publisher, because in the past you never would have been published by Abrams, which is famous for its art books. But the latest book is called Snapshots in History's Glare, and it's filled with pictures, some wonderful pictures that really tell Gore Vidal's life story from beginning to end. Till now, anyway. As a boy, you were also sent to numerous schools, including Los Alamos Ranch School in New Mexico. That property was taken over by the Manhattan Project, wasn't it?
Yes, to forge successfully the atom bomb.
It was also where William S. Burroughs went to school?
He had been at the same school just before me. My mother was a madwoman, and she was driven by all sorts of crazed notions. And one was, she was getting rid of one husband and going on to another, which was something of a pattern with her. And she didn't want any witnesses. And she knew that my beady eyes were attentive to her operations on the home front. And she was married to Mr. Auchincloss, who, when she finally divorced him, he married Jackie Kennedy's mother. That is our relationship, and all due to my mother's restlessness about marriage. And so I ended up being related to dozens of the most extraordinary people on Earth.
How many times did your mother marry?
Well, it weren't that many, but I mean, three, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The last time she was widowed when she was married to Major General Robert Olds, who founded the Fair Ink Command. She almost always married into the Air Force, Wild Blue Yonder and that sort of thing.
Well, I was thinking about going to school with William S. Burroughs, or going to the same school. You sure don't have much in common as writers.
Nor is anything else. You know, it was for disturbed rich boys. Well, my father was not only not rich, he was rather poor.
Even though he was one of the people who helped create airlines like TWA?
Warren Buffett, not long ago, was giving an address on investment money. And he said, you know, a lot of these hot stocks really aren't so good. And he said to listening capitalists, he said, you know, the hottest stocks in the 20s and 30s were airline stocks, and they never declared a dividend. And those were my father's.
Mm-hmm.
And he started what became, the TWA, and Eastern Air, and Northeastern. He still owned a piece of that when he died.
And your parents, in fact, had to move in with your grandparents at one point.
Indeed they did. We were a real Depression family, and the restive wife is trapped with her husband there. And she was all set to marry somebody called John Hay Whitney, who was a very rich man. And my father was having a long romantic friendship, but that was all it was on his side, with Amelia Earhart. And you'll see more of them if you go see the movie, which I have yet to see, but I'm told it's pretty good, about Amelia's life and times, in which Ian McGregor plays my father. And there's some kid who plays me, age 10.
Well, you did wind up going to Exeter, which is not exactly a poor boy's school.
Yes, it is. I was looked after.
You were president of the Debating Society, and I'm assuming that you developed skills that came in handy throughout your life.
Oh, I'll say they did. And actually, we had a magazine called the Exeter Review, and I was one of the three editors. And I can only say it prepared me for the real world. I was able successfully to get through 3 years of the Exeter Review, a schoolboy magazine. And I survived it. And it was quite extraordinary because later I was to have the same job on Partisan Review, which was the Manhattan, the best magazine off the island of Manhattan. And all of the important writers of that period were writing for PR, specifically Saul Bellow. And that was easy after the Exeter Review. The schoolboy mag was the tough one.
You went into the Navy, although that wasn't your family tradition. And then your first novel, Willawah, dealt with World War II. You say there was a reluctance by mainstream publishers at first to print novels about the war.
Oh, yeah, they didn't want to. They said everybody's too close to it now.
We're hearing the same thing today, aren't we?
Well, yes,
you know, you can't, even though a film like The Hurt Locker got incredibly great reviews, it didn't really do as well at the box office as those reviews would have suggested.
Well, you've been in this business a long time, as have I, and one common denominator decade after decade is publishers are still back in 1920 publishing what they think the readers wanted to read then, and then they discover too late it's too late, and they've made a wrong guess.
So what happened when you wrote The City on the Pillar, which was one of the first books to deal with homosexuality openly?
Well,
was there resistance by publishers?
Oh, yes. New York Times refused to take any advertising or to review it or to review my next six or seven novels.
They were really blacklisting you?
Oh,
was
yes.
That because Orville Prescott, who wrote reviews, objected, or was this an editorial decision?
It's both. It started with Orville Prescott, who was a hack reviewer in those days. And he kept right on until he finally retired. And I published a book called Julian, which was successful all over the world. And he came out of retirement to review it and give it a bad review. So he was true to his colors.
Just homophobia, do you think?
Nothing else. He was also very stupid, you know, but who is to criticize a professional bookman?
You also blacklisted by the Hearst newspaper, so it wasn't just the Times. But
no, that was politics. That was the New Deal, because my father was the leading New Dealer for aviation, and William Randolph Hearst wanted to get in on it.
Was the problems you had with The City on the Pillar, which also sold quite well, didn't it?
Oh, yes.
Is that the reason you started writing books under pseudonyms like Edgar Box?
Well, I didn't do it for joy, I'll tell you that. No, that's exactly why I had to do it. And I would get wonderful reviews in the New York Times, which wouldn't review anything under my name.
And they had no idea that you were Edgar Box?
No, finally I brought out three of those books as Edgar Box, under my own name. And I got a violently bad review from the New York Times, which had praised all three books, as long as it was called by Mr. Box.
My guest is Gore Vidal, also known as Edgar Box. His latest book is a mix of photographs, letters, and text called Snapshots in History's Glare. It's published by Abrams. You mentioned Howard Oster. How did you meet him?
Well, how do you meet anybody in New York? Everybody meets everybody else sooner or later.
Well, he was in the advertising business, wasn't he?
Trying to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let him in because he was Jewish. And his name was Oster. And he asked me what he should do about it. I don't know what to do about that, but if they're objecting to your name, change the R to an N and you'll get a job. My advice worked. And he got a job with BBDO as Howard Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And the R was lost forever.
And you were together for how many years?
Over 50.
He passed away a few years back. Mm-hmm. Had he also been involved in your work? Was this one of those relationships where you handed the manuscript over to him and said, what do you think of my writing today?
No. I never handed my work over to anybody, just the public.
Over the course of your career, you've also run for a House seat in New York and the Senate in California. What do you think? You were famous. Other people with your kind of fame and politics have done very well. Were people aware that you were gay? Do you think that was a reason that you didn't win?
Well, that never crossed my mind. Efforts were made to smear, as they still are. You see, this is a country where if you can't answer somebody's political argument, you smear them. That's what we've been seeing rather lately.
Well, somebody threatened, actually, an anonymous caller threatened to distribute copies of The City and the Pillar if you continued to run in the 1960 race. What was your response?
I said, I'll pull out if you... They said they would send a million copies up 29th District in upstate New York. And I said, make it 2 million, I'll draw out.
You still would have gotten your royalties.
Yes, they were trying to get them, but they didn't.
Is that when you met Paul Newman? Because he campaigned for you.
Yeah, he and Joanne. They're going to be at the Y fairly soon when I'm there.
She's
going to be there.
Yeah, Paul is no longer... So many of the people in this book are no longer with us, unfortunately.
Well, you'll find them in the book. And they found up at Harvard some letters that he'd written me. Well, he's one of the funniest letter writers that you've ever seen. And I was amazed. I was just rereading it, waiting to come see you. And I was looking through the book, and there's a letter from Paul Newman, saying about, it's been a wonderful summer and everything has gone so well for everybody and everybody's ill.
You and Christopher Fry wrote the screenplay for Ben-Hur and then were denied a writing credit. Why?
Because the guild was venal and often did that. They took joy in stealing credits and giving them to their friends. And I had vowed I'd get them one day, and I sued them years later on another attempt that they had made to steal a credit. And I got Bert Fields, the best lawyer in L.A., and we went to war, and I won the suit. And a very brilliant lady justice on the Supreme Court of the state of California, she made a great decision. She said, a writer is only his credits in this town. And when you start taking them away from him and reassigning them in a star chamber manner, you are not only depriving a worker of his livelihood, but you are, in a sense, wrecking the record. No, it was a great decision. The Writers Guild to this day has never, never acknowledged their defeat.
Or the judgment
of the Supreme Court of the state of California, to whom they had appealed.
So your name still doesn't appear on Ben-Hur?
No, of course not. Mind you, I would have taken it off because I didn't like the movie. That's something else.
Yeah, well, you and Cecil B. DeMille, I do not see that working well.
Well, I don't know. It was jolly.
You have, many people remember the debates you had with William F. Buckley, and when he died fairly recently, everybody talked about what a great man he was. You say that he was like Hitler, but without the charm. He believed that the bigger the lie, the more it would be accepted.
Well, he proved it all the time. He understood American media very, very well. And if you said something vicious about somebody very famous, you would be immediately believed in the United States because we're basically a rather bitchy people. And anybody's success wounds everyone else, or seems to.
Well, you've said mean things to other people. You called George W. Bush America's very own Caligula.
And that was the least of what I said.
President Truman, you compared to the Roman tyrant Tiberius.
Well, I said that Tiberius was my favorite emperor.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you why. When he succeeded, as Augustus was dead, he became emperor. And suddenly the Senate sent him a document to the effect that whatever he wanted in the way of legislation as emperor, they would grant. And he sent them back word. I'm telling this story now because I want the listeners to listen. Tiberius was a great man. He sent back word to the Senate. He said, this is ridiculous. Anything that comes from the Palatine, which is the palace where he lived, you will accept without discussion, without consultation with the emperor. He said, this is not acceptable. Suppose the emperor's mad. Suppose he's been replaced and you don't know it. And so forth and so on. It's very good sense from Tiberius. And the Senate, being as dumb as they often are, even in our own enlightened day, they sent it back to him again, accepting every word of Caesar's as law. And his secretary said, well, what, sir, are we going to do with this? And he said, I have no message for them. No, he said, you might tell them this. And this is what I would say if I were emperor today. How eager you are to be slaves.
We don't have time to get into your thoughts about the Obama presidency so far, but I wonder about something you've often quoted, Tolstoy's remark, that history would be an excellent thing if it only were true. How should I apply it to this book?
Well,
here you have the documents. I guess I have to trust
To trust it, and what would be my motivation for changing it? I don't have things to disguise. And no, I think that is what makes me an irritating figure to many people, since practically everybody I meet in the political world is lying about something.
Why have you moved back to the United States if you feel that way? Weren't you happier when you were living in Italy?
Yes, I was. But this is my subject.
Mm-hmm.
I've done nothing but spend my life writing about the history of this country. I'm not going to walk away from that.
And now we have that combined with the history of Gore Vidal in this book from Abrams called Snapshots in History's Glare. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Good to see you again.
We'll be rebroadcasting some favorite interviews from the past few months on tomorrow's show, starting off with Zachary Karabell on how the American and Chinese economies have become one fused codependent system, and then celebrity chef David Chang on his first cookbook, Momofuku, also Stephen Healy on his book, How I Became a Famous Novelist, plus a panel discussion on writing crime novels set in New York City. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Alice Castle, Sarah Mizell, and Josh Bell. Michael Lupica was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.